Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Gerald Russello with us. He's published before in First Things, and we see you at a lot of First Things events as well. Gerald, he is the editor of the University Bookman. Before we get into this, what's the University Bookman again?
Thanks, Mark. Happy to be here. The University Bookman is a book review founded in 1960 by Russell Kirk. Originally, it was a quarterly distributed with National Review, but now in recent years, we are online. You can find us at the kirkcenter.org website. We publish pretty regularly, 3 to 4 reviews, interviews, essays, as well as hosting events in New York and elsewhere, basically on issues of enduring importance to the culture.
What's the website?
Quickest access is kirkcenter.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at ubookman.
Okay. And you probably have, an email newsletter
We do.
Notes going out when things pop up on the site.
We do. We have a regular editorial email that goes out as to what our contributors are doing on the site and elsewhere. And you can find that also on the Kirk Center website.
Great. Well, our topic today is a book by Russell Kirk. It first appeared in 1957, and it has been reissued this year. It has an introduction by some guy named Wilfred McClay. I've never heard of him, but it's been reissued. It's a nice little paperback book issued by Renyery Gateway, and it was a little. But what was the book originally? 1957. Kirk does this a few years after The Conservative Mind comes out, which turns out to be a big publication. Renyery did The Conservative Mind, correct?
Correct.
And here now we have this little book that comes out. It's only, it's 103 pages long. What originally was the point?
Sure. So you're exactly right, Mark. In 1953, Kirk comes out with his great book, The Conservative Mind, which is a huge splash. Gets covered in the New York Times, Time Magazine, really everywhere, and really puts modern conservatism on the map. He publishes another book a couple years later called A Program for Conservatives, which lays out some more practical or topical subjects and things for conservatives to think about. And then this book comes out really as a summary of conservative principles for the 1950s. People who want to know, how should conservatives think about community? How should they think about government or power?
And this time, conservatism is, it's sort of off the map.
That's exactly
right.
For most
people.
That's exactly right. In the 1950s, centrist liberalism is the political ideology of the day, right?
We had Democrats in office since 1932.
That's right. Conservatism is...
Until 1952, till Eisenhower.
And conservatism is considered in the, I think it was Lionel Trilling, sort of irritable mental gestures, resembling ideas, right? That's what people thought of conservatism. The Conservative Mind, which is a history, an intellectual history of conservative thought from Burke, Edmund Burke, through initially George Santayana and then later expanded to T.S. Eliot, really brings this tradition of thought to the fore. And this book, which comes out in 1957, is not it's not an academic treatise. It's not a result of his doctoral studies the way The Conservative Mind was. But Kirk wrote this really as a handbook,
For
people to understand what conservatism is and was and what it's not.
First sentence gets right to the beginning. Modern conservatism took form about the beginning of the French Revolution, when far-seeing men in England and America perceived that if humanity is to conserve the elements in civilization that make life worth living, some coherent body of ideas must resist the leveling and destructive impulse of fanatic revolutionaries. There it is. Conservatism then is a response to...
Right. It is initially a political and cultural response to the French Revolution. Edmund Burke writes his famous Reflections on the Revolution in France, which is the touchstone text for Kirk, in opposition to the revolutionaries both in France as well as their friends and allies in England at the time who sought to impose this social and political leveling, both economically, politically, culturally, in France and in the United Kingdom. And Kirk saw that in 1957, that their heirs to that fanatic ideology were very much with us in the 50s, in the forms either of cultural revolutionaries who wanted to level all sort of cultural distinctions, to economic revolutionaries who wanted to centralize economics through state planning.
And that means that conservatism, it's anti-fanatical, right? It is, as Burke would put it, what, gradualist, right? They're not anti-change, but they are about understanding change in cautious way, change that rates, that maintains respect for the wisdom of the past. There was a wisdom of the past, and the revolutionary, of course, says,
That's exactly right.
What wisdom of the past?
That's exactly right. And in this book, Kirk defines conservatism as the negation of ideology. And for Kirk, ideology is a charged word. That is everyone who thinks you can have heaven on earth, either through, in some senses, economic absolutism or cultural leveling, a number of different ways that people think you can achieve paradise here. The conservative thinks that that is not only a losing battle, but ultimately a self-destructive one.
You know, I have to point out to readers, there are so many great lines in this book that people should go through this and write, copy them out in their copybook of maxims. Early on, we have Kirk listing the essence of conservatism, and he lists a series of principles, he calls them. Number 9, men and women are not perfectible. Conservatives, no. And neither are political institutions. Perfectibility was, of course, the fundamental motivation of the revolution, the French Revolution, and Rousseau's idea that we are perfectible. We can get better and better and better. We can become near, you know, every step we're getting closer to perfection, and no sense that, you know, we can actually go backwards. We can actually devolve instead of evolving. But the next line here, we cannot make a heaven on earth, though we may make a hell. I think every conservative should have that written, you know, on the mirror.
That's exactly right.
We can make a heaven. We can't make heaven. We can certainly make hell.
That's
we can
right.
do that.
That's
no
exactly
problem.
Right. And in the 50s and 60s and 70s, with the various revolutionary movements in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, many places were made a hell in an attempt to make it a heaven. And this is. I'm glad that you highlighted this, Mark. This is very important because, but for two reasons. First, at this point, Kirk is confronting liberalism in the United States, certainly a very heavy socialist bent in the United Kingdom, with which he was very close and had traveled there often. He was friends with T.S. Eliot, actually owned a house in Scotland for a while. And this is his core insight, that we are a mixture of good and evil, that we are not blueprints, we're not machines, and we cannot be manipulated in that way to achieve some perfect end.
Would Kirk put it in terms of original sin?
He would, although interestingly, when this book was written, he was sort of a non-practicing, non-denominational Christian. He converts mm-hmm. to Catholicism later in life. But you're right, he had a very strong sense of original sin, our capacity to do evil. And he also had a very strong sense, in all his work really, of the irreducible mystery of human existence, that we cannot really know the depths of each individual's heart and soul. And because of that, our government, our politics, our culture need to recognize those limitations.
I'm going to jump to the present and just say that this is what I find lacking in the social justice warriors, the protesters out there on college campuses, for instance. No sense of, one, the fragility of the good that we create in a society. And second, really the tragic condition, the tragic sense of life embodied here in the phrase, we can't make a heaven, but we can make a hell. And what makes it tragic is there's no overcoming that. There's no elimination in this world with human beings and all these fallen creatures that we are, if you do not have that tragic sense of life, then you're liable, you're vulnerable to the utopian temptation. Why can't things get better? Why can't everyone be happy? Come on, we can change it. We can act.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And in the 60s, of course, Kirk faced his own set of college revolutionaries, right, who sought to overturn what they thought is an oppressive or restrictive educational regime in the name of liberation. And I think you see their errors today. It's the construct of a lot of movements on campus is a rejection of the past, a liberation towards some unknown future, but without that tragic sense, without the idea that we can regress and that the knowledge of history, for example, can show us how and when societies can go backwards and go back to barbarism, and without recognition that we're all a mixture of good motives and evil motives. And Kirk was very strongly a proponent of that tragedy and that mystery. He actually often recommended Miguel de Unamuno's book, The Tragic Sense of Life, for that reason. And he was very conscious of that. And he opposed, you mentioned Rousseau, in a lot of his work, Rousseau is the nemesis. He is the one of endless freedom, right, endless liberation that Kirk shows almost inevitably ends up in chains, usually of our own making.
You know, the desire, for instance, to take down the statues of Robert E. Lee and Thomas Jefferson. The fervent, the zeal to go after figures in the past with clay feet seems to me to evince the absence of a tragic sense. Mm-hmm. Of life, and of the mix in human beings of good and evil, and you just wonder if you can't look upon Thomas Jefferson as a flawed man and also a great man, then you do have a simplistic conception of human nature. And it's also as if I'm going to fix the past, not just the present, I'm going to fix the past.
Well, that's very Orwellian, right? He who controls the past controls the present and the future. And I think what Kirk would say is that the difficulty with those movements is that, to your point, they have no natural end point. That is to say that they attack memory itself. And so you can argue about the Confederate statues, but then you look at something like the Peace Cross in the cemetery in Maryland that the Supreme Court was hearing argument on, where certain groups wanted to tear down the cross for being offensive and knock out the statue and the plaque that commemorates World War I veterans. Now, why is that important?
Well, because... Wait, what? Why did they want to tear it? Is it on public... property,
it is or? On a public. It was originally owned by the American Legion and is now owned on a public park. But the plaque underneath that cross lists the World War I soldiers who died overseas, whose bodies were not brought back. But the distinction of races and classes of Americans in that list is a testament to the better parts of our civic past, but to the ideologue, because the symbolism may be offensive to some, it all must disappear. And that is the leveling impulse that Kirk talks about. It's an inability to distinguish between what is worth preserving and what is not, because memory itself is an affront, because it reminds us that we are not perfect.
There's a scene in that movie, The Killing Fields, which was about the Cambodian Revolution. And it's in one of the re-education moments at night. They work in the camps, then they have their re-education at night. And I think the line by the leader was, today is year zero, or today is year one. I can't remember, zero or one. But in other words, the past. No, we're starting now. We're beginning anew. And that's the radical revolutionary position, right? What makes it radical is the root, right? We're digging things out by the roots. We're canceling the past, and we can start over. We can start over.
Right. But what that means ultimately for Kirk, at least, is that someone is in charge of telling you what is now to be remembered and what is not.
But they always have pure motives, right?
right.
The ones in charge.
Right. Of course. And
they should be in charge.
Right. Because they have the best motives and the best reasons for acting. Right.
They're the good.
And that there's a chapter in this very book that talks about conservatives and power.
Right.
And he goes, Kirk talks about that, that power is tempting, obviously, and it is often tempting to people with the wrong motives. And because you cannot always trust the people with power, you need to keep it limited and focused and channeled.
And this is what the neglect of history will do. You can say to yourselves, well, they did it wrong. We'll get it right this time.
Right.
That wasn't real socialism. we're gonna get real socialism this time. There's always a next time,
right
here, because the lessons of the past are they got it wrong.
We are right. We are correct, and we know we're correct because we have the right motives. And I do think that there's in and Kirk would certainly see this in contemporary ideological movements. There is this sense that if I think it, it must be right because I am a good person. And so therefore, the damage that I might do as part of a social or cultural program is unfortunate, but it must be done because I know that I only have the best in mind. And that's a very dangerous place to be. And the study of history, among other things, tells us that we can deceive ourselves as to our motives.
And you know, when early on in that chapter, The Essence of Conservatism, Kirk writes, conservatives distrust what Burke called abstractions, right? Abstractions, that is, absolute political dogmas divorced from practical experience in particular circumstances. Now, I think the danger of those abstractions is they can become powerful to the point where you end up sacrificing real things and real people to that abstraction. And I remember one Marxist, Eugene Genovese, he once said to me when I said, Gene, how could you stay a communist for so long? Through the 70s,
right.
You know, after all the show trials came out and Hungary and Prague and everything else, he said, Mark, we believed that if we were going to make the workers' paradise, two generations would have to suffer.
Right.
That's how he put it. So for this abstract, this vision, okay, two generations of people, they got to be sacrificed. And that abstract conception was so strong that it will make the radical not see the sacrifices, the suffering. Well, it just isn't real.
Right.
It just doesn't become significant in light of the power of this vision.
Well, that's what Eric Hobsbawm, the recently deceased, I guess, Marxist historian, when he was confronted with the crimes of the Soviet Union, and they asked him, if you had known this in the 30s and 40s and 50s when you were a very active communist, or even now, does it change your mind? And he said, no, it wouldn't have changed my mind because the goal, to your point, was so pure that the sufferings in between don't matter. And, you know, this is a very easy case for Kirk of sort of private judgment sort of overcoming historical and human reality, right? And he was very suspicious of people who would set up abstract systems that would cause suffering in the meanwhile. He was much more concerned with, as you know, in a very prosaic way, he would say, brighten the corner where you are. What you do personally, your personal charitable work, your personal kindness, your personal acts of justice, that was more important than an abstract ideological program that you would make others suffer for in order to reach at some unknown point.
Where does the confidence come from? I mean, what makes people believe, as Barack Obama adopted it as a slogan in 2008, we are the ones that we have been waiting for. We're the ones. We're it. We are the first generation in human history that really got it right.
Right.
We know what should be and what we must do. To me, extraordinary hubris.
I think Kirk would localize it in two things. First, would be the general secularization of the culture, right? So when you lose religion, you have to find a source of salvation somewhere. Many people found it in politics. And they lost that sense of original sin or forgiveness and redemption or suffering and transferred all of that into a positive program going forward for which they had no personal salvation at stake, but the society would be better off. And because, as I said, they lack a sense of original sin, so therefore they think their motives are pure and fully knowable by themselves. And so therefore they feel free to say, well, we're the ones because we now understand it.
And you know, there's an interesting complement to the conviction in their own purity, and that is the certainty of their opponent's venality and maliciousness.
Right. Well, that's the other half of it, right? You lose, I think Kirk would say, the increase in secularization and the lack of historical knowledge. So it's easy to caricature your opponents.
Right.
You know more about this than I do, Mark, but the study of history and logic and argumentation in American higher education has declined precipitously. So people no longer even know how to argue. If you disagree with me, therefore you must have a bad motive because I know my motives are pure. So you must be bad. And I don't need to understand where your thinking comes from or if it has any merit, which is in fact one of the reasons why Kirk wrote this book in the 50s, because people had a caricature of conservatives as only wanting the status quo or only wanting to oppress other people.
Bring back the king.
Exactly. and so therefore I don't need to know anything more about you. And I think that unfortunately that kind of argumentation has only gotten worse.
Well, I have argued that every college student should take U.S. history, taught in the old-fashioned way, should take a literature course, taught in the old-fashioned way. But now I think I'm putting logic at the top. Know your P's and Q's.
Right.
Okay. If P, then Q.
Right.
That's what we need first. Here's a line. Explain this. A real conservative, however, cannot be a real individualist. Do you know what he means? Should I give you a context for that, Gerald?
But I think I know what he means by it.
Okay. Well, he says, the thoroughgoing individualist, in the strict sense of the term, is hostile toward religion, toward patriotism, toward the inheritance of property, and toward the past.
Right.
Is that it?
Right. And Kirk was very opposed to that term. And in fact, his correspondence, which just came out in a volume recently, he has letters to people disclaiming and denouncing the term individualist, which in the 50s and 60s was a term that some conservatives were adopting for themselves in contradistinction to a liberal or a socialist.
That's more libertarian?
More libertarian. And in fact, ISI, which is a very well-known conservative organization, was known as the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists at the beginning. And
really?
Kirk mightily opposed that until they changed, and then they subsequently changed their name. And the reason for that is, as you mentioned, Kirk did not think that people lived in a vacuum. We were not atomistic brains that could figure out the world on our own. We came from somewhere. We live somewhere, we interact with people, and that is how we develop as persons. And to say you are an individualist merely means, as Kirk would say, we rely on our own small stock of reason and become like flies of a summer. This is not a human way to live. You must live connected.
I'll make up my own mind about everything. Okay, no one's going to tell me what to think. No one's going to tell me what to do. Okay, Anthony Kennedy told me this. So that I don't have to listen to anything anyone says. The meaning is what I make it.
Right.
So here's how Kirk says it in the next page. It's the conservative is all in favor of individuality, property rights, variety in society, but equally opposed to individualism.
Right. Radical
political ideology. That's where we take sort of the practical sense of individual rights and so on, and we make it an ism, an abstraction.
An abstraction, that's right. And Kirk himself was very much an individual. He lived on his own in his ancestral house in Mecosta, Michigan, in the middle of nowhere, lived by writing on his own, was quite the eccentric, as anyone who knew him would attest. Believed in ghosts, told ghost stories, went for long walks to the Scottish countryside, carried a sword cane on the streets of New York, was very much an eccentric person, but he was not an individualist of any kind.
Right. I mean, one thing that goes against this, there's a chapter in here called Conservatives in the Family. All right. The core unit is not the individual. The core unit is the family. The conservative feels that the family is the natural source and core of any good society. Not the free individual, but the family. When the family decays, a dreary collectivism is sure to supplant it.
Right.
That's an interesting formulation.
Right. Well, Kirk saw the family as obviously a core of civilization, but also the prime example of the obligations and responsibilities we owe one another. That is how most of us develop as persons in the context of a family. And if you destroy the family, as many, as you know, Mark, many collectivist regimes did, that is what they targeted.
Got to take those infants away from their parents.
And they did that to
raise them right.
Raise them right. Right. You know, in accordance with our good motives. And as Kirk says, what that means is there is no bulwark between yourself and your family and the state. There's no one to turn to, and so you must turn to the government or to the organs of the state, which leads to, as Kirk says, a dreary collectivism.
You know, it just occurs to me, you know, in Fahrenheit 451, published, what, 1951, the main character, Montag, the guy who burns books, his wife sits around taking pills and watching sort of a soap opera all day long on the three walls of her room.
Right.
And I think the soap opera is called The Family.
Right.
Right?
Right. Right.
I don't have a real family, but I've got this virtual family. And it's very state regulated and so on.
Right.
And I think that Bradbury was onto something there, realizing that you break up families, you need some other kind of family.
Right.
A spurious family.
Right.
Something
else.
A personal belonging. Of course, it doesn't work. It's not a real family.
It's not a real family. That's right. And I think Kirk would say, not only does the government do this by performing functions that supplant the family, but also, you know, another ism, a ideological capitalism will also do that by turning us all into consumers. You know, our family is Apple, or our family is whatever, some other company that tells us, you don't need anybody else. You be you. You know, you develop your own reality. We're here to help you do that as long as, you know, with our products.
Right.
The both of those tend to be very strong solvents of family life that Kirk thought.
Good. Last, conservatives and education, right? Education. Education is probably, is that the field in which conservatism has the least influence, public education in our society?
I think that's
It could be.
Could be.
But here, Kirk says, the conservative does not forget that the essential aim and the chief benefit of formal education is to make people intelligent and good. How simple. Nice formulation. I think Lionel Trilling, did he know what Trilling? Did they interact at all?
Not in any substantive way, so far as I can tell.
Okay. Hey, Kirk didn't have much contact with the Partisan Review world?
No. When he first started writing...
I mean, they were all socialists, for one thing.
Right, for one thing. When he first started writing, he was mostly writing for United Kingdom periodicals. Faber, through the work of T.S. Eliot, brought out the conservative mind in England. And he was splitting his time between Michigan and Scotland for much of the 50s into the 60s.
Okay. Well, Trilling has the line, the moral obligation to be intelligent. I like that line.
Yeah.
You are morally obligated to know some history.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
This is, you don't know any history. There's something wrong there. You've committed a moral crime if you don't do that. And one thing about the Partisan Review group, they were cultural conservatives and political socialists.
Right. Right.
That was actually produced an interesting mix of ideas back then. I don't think that is possible to be both now. It's hard to be. But to make people, schools cannot wholly by themselves make people intelligent and good, you know, family, the environment you're in, but schools can help in the process. And if they neglect this primary function in favor of vague schemes, there's that abstraction kind of thing, vague schemes for, quote, group play or personality, learning by doing. That's actually a phrase that we still have.
Yes, we do.
Here. Learning by doing, project learning. We don't want to get, you know, we don't want to have any more facts kind of stuff. Then they have become bad schools.
Right.
And I think that's something just to become intelligent and good.
Right, yeah, and Kirk thought that through the study of history, that was possible. He often praised Plutarch, for example, to give us good and bad examples of people of how to live. And he wrote often about children's literature and how that helps form character to be good and intelligent, to understand our past.
The founders thought, Plutarch, lessons in leadership.
Yeah.
We learn from the past. We learn the mistakes. We look at the Roman Republic and we understand how it succumbed to the empire.
Right.
And we need to know these things. And we work them into this little model of government that we create. And I don't understand why people don't say, oh, I learned from the past.
Right. Well, because you're going to read something, as Kirk says somewhere, and I don't know if it's in this book, he says, if you're not going to read Shakespeare and Dante, you're going to read Mad Ghoul comics. That's to say, you are going to ingest cultural influences no matter what you do. And what the schools need to do, as well as family and religion and other institutions, is to inculcate us to know the difference. Because you are not an individual. And so you have to be thoughtful about what that is.
I tell my students, I give them the old line, tell me what you like and I'll tell you who you are. Mm-hmm. No one talks to them that way in the education system today. They think that their entertainments, their diversions are somehow separate from the, No. This is deep in your sensibility. Right. It is forming, and you want to, you know, expose yourself to the good, the true, the lovely, whatever is praiseworthy. Think on these things.
Right. Exactly.
So, and I think that's the cultural conservatism, right? Argument right there. All right, Jeff. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And that's great. I'm gonna mention the book again. Russell Kirk's Concise Guide to Conservatism. I think all of us should purchase it. For our teenage children. I've got to get my son on this one this summer.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.